This is BC Spritch, your look at the province's burgeoning distilling culture. What is happening, BC Spritz? Welcome back to the podcast, your number one authority on BC distilleries and spirits. I'm your host, Sean Sewell. This week is a live stream I did a little while ago, actually, with Lauren and Jonathan from Bitted Sling. So we're going to get behind one of the very first original bitters companies here in BC, sort of talk about entrepreneurship, starting the bitters company, how it's going now, so on and so forth. So I hope you enjoy this episode, guys. Thanks, as always, for the support, and I'll chat to you really soon. Bye.
I always like to start off with origin stories because I always find those the most interesting. And I'm going to give Jonathan the first crack at this one because everybody already knows you really, really well, Lauren. So,
True. It's amazing how much people don't know, but Jonathan, go ahead.
Hi, Sean. My name's Jonathan, a.k.a. Mr. Chop. Thanks for having us. It's awesome to chat. We've chatted, from time to time on our happy hour calls, and it's always great to see your face. So here we are talking about Bitter Sling and
your origin story.
My origin story.
That's what he's asking.
Nobody wants to know my
origin story of how we started today's call. So when I came back in from outside,
I woke up this morning.
Come on.
And it was similar to the day before.
You know, he's gonna have to edit this. That's a pain in the butt.
I know, I never edit it. It's good. It goes straight through.
Yeah, I've watched his show. I know that I can just play and where's my guitar? Okay.
All right, I'm gonna go make dinner.
Hi, I'm Mr. Chop. And in 1993, I moved from Ontario to beautiful British Columbia. It was a summer, and it was, for me, I was a small town kid from St. Mary's, Ontario, the Stone Town. I often joke to people that, you know, my first job was actually picking rocks. And they say, no, what'd you really do? It's like, no, I picked rocks. I worked on farms and I walked in front of a tractor and picked large rocks out of the fields and put them into the bucket of the tractor. And I worked on farms and baled hay and fed cows and learned how to drive motorbikes and had a really amazing young life living in the country. My friends were horses and cows that, were on the fence perimeter of our yard. We had a big garden growing up, and my mom and dad, they didn't really cook much. They actually started cooking more when I actually became a chef. And that was after 1 year in Vancouver. So small town guy flies out to Vancouver because I met a girl and she said, I'm moving to Vancouver. Do you want to come? I said, yes. So I left high school and moved to Vancouver, and I ended up having a friend of our principal in Ontario. The friend who lived in Vancouver proctored my final exams in Vancouver so I could just go out and finish things early and finish high school. And I found myself in Vancouver. I played guitar. I was interested in being a rock star. And when that wasn't happening after a year of not being a rock star, I was working in a toy warehouse.
Still a rock star, though.
In North Burnaby.
He rocks out here at home.
I was shipping toys to Carney's in North Burnaby and realized I needed to figure out what was next.
The 90s. Okay.
I'm not sure if this is going to be my greatest episode ever or the most regrettable.
No, it's the greatest episode ever.
So kids, this is in 1993. And so anyway, I thought the Food Network had just started and Emeril was on, and that sort of first wave of cooking shows was on TV all the time. So I was watching a lot of that at home and cooking a little bit. And I thought, well, this could be an avenue. And so I literally was sitting at the warehouse one day and I called Vancouver Community College. And I said, I'd love to sign up for the 1 year cooking program. They said, well, there's an 8 month waiting list. I said, oh, okay. But they said, if you have the tuition money ready on hand, which I think at the time was like $3,500, this is Vancouver Community College. if you've got the money handy, we'll put you on a short list, because people, they sign up and then right before the class starts, they either don't have the cash or they're doing something else, they drop out. And then we call people just like, 1, 2, 3, 4, can you start? And I said, okay, put me on that list. And I called my dad at home and I said, hey, this is what I'm thinking about doing, because I didn't have any money in the bank at all. I was working in a toy warehouse, and I had any dollar I had went to my 78 Les Paul Custom and my Fender Strats and yada, yada. I called my dad and said, listen, I've signed up on this short list, and you know, I don't know if they will call. It's a long shot, but I really need to get out of here. He said, keep me posted. I called the college on a Monday. That following Friday, they called me and said, we have an opening. If you're ready to start, you start school on Monday. And I said, I'm in. Sign me up. So I walked upstairs. I still remember my boss's name was Jerry. I said, Jerry, I'm going to cooking school. And he said, that's great. When are you going? I said, Monday. And he said, well, I think you're going to make a lot of people fat, and it's good. You know, good luck. So literally that Monday, my dad transferred the money into my bank account. I started school on that Monday and I started cooking, and that led me down a path that took me to Vancouver Island in 1995. I started working at a Relais & Chateau property called the Airy Resort. And this is sort of like this mythical Mediterranean castle on the top of,
the Malahat
Hill,
the Malahat. I was blanking on the name. Oh my God. The Malahat, your backyard, Sean.
It's because he's next to the Alps now. He forgot.
So many mountains in my life. So I started working at the Airy, and the teams that came through that kitchen, I spent 5 years there. The teams that came through that kitchen were amazing. I learned so much. This was in 95 to 99, and I was blown away by all the farms that we were working with. People would bring whitetail fallow deer to the kitchen. We were getting Shaunigan Lake white asparagus. We were getting Bill Jones bringing mushrooms from the forest. We were getting these crayfish, Dungeness crab and rockfish fishermen coming in. They would drive all night from Tofino, and they'd come in the morning, and we'd give them beer and money and then take their fish. And it was just we had a huge garden that was growing herbs and edible flowers. And for me, that was my first cooking job. And I thought, this is how it's done. This is how it's done in the world, right?
Oh, no.
So then after the Airy, I went and spent a year at the beautiful gardens of Souk Harbor House on southern Vancouver Island. And it was farm to table, but to the nth degree. It was nothing in that kitchen except for coffee and chocolate was from an area outside of the island. And it was so hyper local and so hyper seasonal. We changed the menu every day. Again, the people that I was working with in that kitchen were of just such a high level, and the amount of immersive learning from the cooks, from the gardeners, from the sommeliers, from the waiters. It was such a magical place. And then I moved to Toronto, and so I moved to Toronto because at this point I was 24.
He followed another girl to Toronto.
You
didn't deny it either.
I followed you to Amsterdam.
It's true.
It's manifest destiny. It's manifest destiny. So I moved to Toronto, and you know, I had this like hyper local sensibility about cooking. Plus, I was a 24-year-old arrogant little prick, and I, you know, thought this is how it's done. Little did I know that wasn't how it was done there. But I was lucky enough to get a job initially working with Chris McDonald at Avalon. At the time, Avalon was one of the best restaurants in the country. and it was super high-end fine dining again. But instead of being super local and seasonal, the chef Chris McDonald brought the best ingredients from around the globe. So fish were being flown in 3 times a week from the Mediterranean. We were getting lobsters from the East Coast. We were getting mushrooms from Northern Ontario. And, you know, we were working with seasonality as well, but it was really about luxury and a really refined sense of fine dining. You know, we wanted to be like the French Laundry, meets El Bulli. And at the time, Chris, the chef, he was the first person that I ever met in person that had eaten at El Bulli, which, you know, was, you know,
special.
Well, later on, it came to define the industry. But at the time, what Chris was doing was, you know, just sort of gleaning those modernist techniques. And even in Toronto, the dining public wasn't full on ready for it yet. That guy is a genius and so far ahead of his time.
But what about the other people that came and worked there as well? Like, for context, people that you're still friends with now, like Cam and Dana from Joy Road Catering.
Yeah. So I met Cam and Dana, founders of Joy Road Catering, now vagabonds in a van driving around the
world.
North America. I think the van is actually a submarine. So they're going to visit us in a couple of months. They're going to drive across and then go under. Cam and Dana, you know, so many great chefs. But I don't want to get bogged down in this because I ended up leaving Toronto because the food scene there wasn't what I had started cooking, which was, where are we? What season is it? And what is the best now in this place? And I ended up going back to Vancouver Island. And I worked with a guy named David Faze at Faze and Hobbs Catering. And David actually fired me. He fired me cruelly and viciously because he's a cruel and vicious man. And I had just moved from Toronto to Victoria. And this guy...
Best podcast ever.
For this job. And you know, Faze and his dog Hobbs, they fired my young, sweet ass. And I didn't know what I was going to do. So I called my buddy Edward Tucson, and I told him what had happened. And he said, call Peter. And so I called Peter Zambri. And Pete said, okay, come for lunch. I went for lunch. Literally, this is all me on my cell phone walking home from getting fired. Call Edward, call Peter. I walk to Zambri's, have lunch with Peter. Peter hires me, and I start work the next day. And then that again was an incredibly amazing, immersive experience in local seasonal Italian cuisine. And working with Pete changed my life. Derek Damon was one of the chefs at the time there. So the line was literally myself, Derek, and Pete cooking for the small little room, 36 seats. But it was just some of the most magical, most incredible times. And I learned so much. You know, some 5 years in, I guess, at this point in my career. And the accelerated learning curve was just really, really incredible. I'll always have Peter as one of my greatest mentors in my life. So this led me back to BC. And then I did some gigs in the Great Bear Rainforest. I was the exec chef of King Pacific Lodge for a few years. And, you know, we foraged for our own seaweed. We got sea urchins and sea cucumbers and, you know, worked with the Gitgat First Nations on indigenous, you know, curing techniques and fish harvesting techniques. I learned a new way to actually butcher a halibut, which is different from the classical European way of butchering a halibut. One of the dudes that I worked with is like, that's not how you butcher a halibut. And then he showed me, and it's like this open book method of doing it, which is way more, it yields more flesh. You know, I started showing that to cooks, you know, in the years since. It's incredible. British Columbia, and it's, I didn't grow up there, but I really came alive there and became who I am today there.
The chop you are
today. And, you know, we live in Amsterdam now. I still, when I think about home, my parents live in Ontario. My sister lives in Ontario with her family. But when I think of home, I think of Vancouver and Vancouver Island.
I feel the same way. I came here when I was 26, and everybody's like, "Oh, yeah," because I've never gone home. It's been 14 years since I went home, and it's because I think I grew up here on the island. I was 26. I left all my buddies, came to Canada with like $4,000 in my pocket, and I grew up in Victoria. Victoria's my home. So now that we've Sean Finter said, "How can Jonathan's hair look so good during the middle of a pandemic?"
It's because he just bought this.
Sean, this arrived today. I ordered it two months ago.
Sean, everyone's seen your photos on Facebook of other people cutting your hair. Let's just get one thing straight here. I do not do anything to Jonathan's hair except a little trim around the ears so he doesn't look like a hockey player. But we've just decided.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
No, it's fine. But it's springtime now, which means he needs to have his summertime chop hair, and he's just decided not to cut it.
Sean, let's do a poll. Should I bring back the knob, the nub, the top knot?
Oh no, I'm not getting into that whatsoever. No, I'm not getting into that discussion whatsoever. My wife did a haircut for me, and she like I usually go high and tight, but she went very high and very tight.
And so listen, it looks great, man.
So this is all grown back in. So now that Jonathan's told the world how he got his start, Lauren, how did you get yours? You're from Toronto originally too, aren't you?
Yeah, I was just coloring while he was talking. He was just going on and on. And I'm like,
listen, I'm very old. There's a lot of story to tell.
And he also forgets. He like stops talking and then he's like, what was I talking about?
The Malahat.
Toys! The Malahat! Oh, my God. And he just, like, fully yelled away. I'm deaf now. Okay, so there's ringing in my ear. What was your question, Sean?
You're originally from Ontario and Toronto.
Oh, yes.
Almost, right?
But I am born and raised downtown Toronto, super vagabond kid. My two brothers and I, and we grew up basically shopping for comics on Yonge Street. So my mom and dad were both in the entertainment business, and we were brought up in a family that were obsessed with movies, obsessed with comics, with writing, with books, with anything to do with pop culture. And it was really interesting and similar to, you know, maybe Jonathan's vision of the industry when he started. I thought all families were like that, but they weren't. my brothers and I, since then, we all live in different places. My older brother, Sasha, lives in Zurich. I live in Amsterdam now, and Jake lives in Toronto, also in the industry after a successful, well, I guess partially successful career as a filmmaker. He decided to change careers a couple of years ago and apply his learning in the film business to, I guess, a very similar clientele in the bar and restaurant industry, which is pretty cool. But I guess my upbringing was always about how I could focus everything on art and on people. And I just didn't know how I was going to do that. I didn't know if that would be through, becoming an artist necessarily, or if that was through food, if it was through drinks. I was actually, I was scheduled to go to law school, and I applied as a mature student after high school. I took 5 years off just to work in the industry because I loved being with people, and I loved, I guess, being on stage in the bar and restaurant atmosphere. I always wanted to be a professional cook, but I didn't want to be trapped behind closed doors in a restaurant. So I opened a catering company and was cooking in my neighborhood while I was studying. I went to school and studied peace and conflict studies and international relations. And again, that was my love for learning about the world and learning about people and understanding how to communicate. And that's really what post-secondary school teaches you, is how to communicate. But I never really found, I guess, my calling. I was dabbling in a lot of different things and just trying to figure out how I could take an understanding of global culture and people and human behavior and food and beverage and flavors and how I could just blend it all together. And I think for me, even though this year is my 20th year as a bartender, I don't really count a lot of the earlier years while I was behind the bar, because it just changed so dramatically for me. At one point, supporting myself by bartending was very different than, wow, this is actually my passion and something I can envision doing for the next, three decades, whatever it might be. My first job, if you know, Sean Finter's still commenting on your chat, he will have heard some of the songs that we were singing about chicken burgers, because my first job was at a singing burger shop in Toronto called Licks, which has since gone out of business in the last few years. But they were around for, you know, 25 years. They were the gourmet, you know, quick service, not fast food, but quick service in Ontario. And I loved blending that entertainment aspect with food and beverage. I thought, okay, so there is something here. And that was when I was 14. So I just turned 38. I mean, that was 24 years ago that I had just like this moment of, you know, before I went to university, before I did anything, that there could be something there. So I'm just going to keep maybe my peripheral on it and see what happens. So as I mentioned, you know, the first few bar jobs that I had were sort of just paying bills and just getting to spend time with people and learning more about spirits and food and flavors. But I really think the transformative moment for me was Le Select Bistro in 2003, when
it wasn't Wayne Gretzky's?
No. Well, see, Wayne Gretzky's, what, one of the things that I shouldn't have mentioned? Oh, maybe I should have mentioned it, because I didn't even mention it on any other podcast I've done. Okay. So Wayne Gretzky's, a partial percent, I don't know how much, it was actually owned by Wayne Gretzky, but he was scheduled to make at least 6 visits per year. And him and Walter Gretzky used to be walking through Wayne Gretzky's restaurant every time there was a home game for the Leafs and for World Juniors or for the Olympics, wherever Team Canada was playing. And it was pretty cool. And, you know, for me, I didn't grow up in, I grew up in a sports family in the sense that we all played sports, but we didn't necessarily sit down and watch sport on TV unless it was like the Olympics or Blue Jays, because the Blue Jays won 2 back-to-back World Series in 92, 93. So that we were really involved in. I think it was meeting Gretzky for the first time and some of his other family members was like the crazy proud Canadian moment of, wow, do I actually work for you? And he's like, well, actually you don't. I'm just here 6 times a year. You work for that guy. And I'm like, oh, so it was very different. But I mean, it was a really interesting blend of people that worked there. And I worked behind the bar on Team Canada. So we all had different teams on the schedule. And I remember vividly this guy, Justin, that I worked with. And he was training to be a firefighter. And of course I was, you know, I've always been, you know, into sport and I always liked
it. And into firefighters.
And into firefighters as well. I said, so we got to carry all these like 2x4s up to the top level to like level 3 where the outdoor patio is. And he says, well, how many are you going to carry? And I said, well, I'm going to carry 2. And he's like, well, I'm going to carry 3. And I said, I'm going to carry 3. And so he went much faster than I did. And I was like 1 step at a time, carrying 3 2x4s, and knowing that maybe some of your people that are watching this are international guests. So a 2x4 is a case of 24 bottles of 330 ml beer. so anyway.
So oh, awesome. They gave it a weekend.
Wait, did things just freeze? Can you still hear us?
I can still hear you.
Okay. Okay, cool. Because you were just like frozen in this really excited position. You were like, ah! No more Gretzky's talk. It was really fun though. When I worked for Le Select Bistro in 2003, 2004, it is still there, owned by 2 guys, Frédéric, who is from Alsace, France, and Jean-Jacques, who is from Provence. And it was the first time that I worked for a company where they took the authenticity of global culture that they felt so connected to because it was in their blood. It was their family DNA. They blended that into the most incredible environment of people, of hospitality, of food, of beverage, and unapologetically French, not Quebec, but French. And so there would be moments where like a dish would come out and it would be choucroute garni, and it would come up and Frédéric would pull it aside and say, this is missing the mustard, you know, like it was so unapologetically authentic from the region. And I thought that was really cool. And it was there that I first encountered this, which is probably the largest wine book that I had encountered at that moment. It was the largest cellar in Toronto. There was like a huge scandal when they moved from their original location on Queen Street in the early 2000s to the new location that I worked at, because they had to move their cellar, and their cellar was licensed to one location. So it was like this big public famous to do in Toronto newspapers that the list-select owners are fighting with the government right now because they couldn't move their cellar, which was probably one of the largest in Canada. So it was the place that I fell in love with wine, with food, with service, with hospitality, and the aha moment where I realized this is exactly the path that I need to be on. And I can incorporate all of the things that I have loved growing up, the entertainment, the academic stuff, the education, and the sky was the limit. And they showed me that. And that was really cool. And so I moved to Vancouver in 2007. And I moved to Vancouver having never visited before. I only knew that I wanted to work in the best restaurants in Canada. And in my opinion, it's not that Toronto wasn't that place. I just felt that Toronto, like the front and back of house, weren't communicating. So what the kitchen was doing was really beautiful work, but I felt like unless you were a sommelier of a certain age, perhaps, then you might not have had like the same interaction with the kitchen on menus and service and flavor pairing. Vancouver was just the opposite. And I remember when I was getting ready to move to Vancouver, I mentioned to somebody I worked with at Le Select, one of the managers, his name was Ves Serafov from Bulgaria. And I said, the only place that I want to work at is Lumiere. Why? Because that's where Rob Feeney is. Why? Because he has a TV show. And why? Because it's the only restaurant people were talking about in my mind when I was watching Food Network. It was the only place that existed in Vancouver because nobody else was talking about anything on Food Network. And he said, oh, I think I went to wine school with somebody that worked there. And I said, really? And so he said, I'm not sure like where he works in Vancouver, but I think he could probably point you in the right direction. So I get this call about 2 days later, and on the answering machine, it was Sebastian Legoff. And he said, hi, this is Sebastian Legoff. I was given your name from my friend Vest that I went to WSET with in Ontario. And he mentioned you're moving to Vancouver, and I'm not sure what you have lined up, but I am the director of operations for a wonderful restaurant in Vancouver called Lumiere. And it would be great to interview you because we have the position open for bar manager. I was like, what? That was like the sign of all signs. So I moved there September 9th, 2007. And I guess 3 days later, I started working at Lumiere, total fish out of water, because I had basically spent my entire life in wine and understanding spirits in how they appeared on the shelf. Like I knew about tequila. I understood Scotch whiskey. I understand flavors, but we weren't making cocktails at that point in Toronto. Like it didn't really exist unless you went to certain places. And so I learned very, very quickly that building a cocktail list was really no different than building a menu. And that is why going forward to Chow and to the Refinery and Goldfish, and even just the style of how I make cocktails now, is so rooted in food and so rooted in culinary, because I had no clue in the beginning. I knew how to pair flavors and how to balance weights and sweetness and acid, but I didn't know anything about classics. So I had to like learn things in reverse. And it was probably the most remarkable moment of my career, was understanding that the cocktail world had those classic beginnings in the same way that food did, because I understood the food part really well. I studied it my entire life, and bringing the wine and spirits and cocktails into that fold was the life-changing moment. And I think all of that is, they're all still things that I pull on now in every program that I write, in every cocktail I put together, and in every story or head note that I create. It's all rooted in equal balance of classic food and classic culinary origin.
Because I think I always try and remind a lot of young bartenders these days, like you were just saying, like 2006, 2007, cocktails weren't really a thing in Toronto. They were just sort of getting started in Vancouver. I remember that was around the time I came to Canada. So coming from an Australian background, where Australia cocktail culture has been huge for a decade before I even arrived in Canada. It was interesting to see it basically reset again and sort of grow from nothing. It was going back to Singapore last year was the same sort of thing, even though Singapore, everybody talks about Singapore. I find Singapore still very young. And there wasn't a lot of information out there. It was just when Facebook started, you couldn't just go Google on your smartphone the recipe for an old pal or a boulevardier. You had to really like hunt it all down. Mm-hmm. So fast forward a little bit and let's dive into the bitted sling. What was the driving force behind the bitted sling? Now, which came first? Actually, let me ask that first question. What came first? Did you and Jonathan come first or did bitted sling come first?
Oh, well, you know what?
Chicken and egg.
Eat on this one, but I know Jonathan have a lot to say here. Making bitters was something that I did before I met Jonathan. We started making them at Chow, and we started doing all kinds of homemade things at Chow because it was very food driven. And so using culinary technique in the bar was something that was expected. And then at the refinery, that's where it went like really crazy. Like Sean, when you and I first met was back then, I think at a Whistler beer cocktail competition, if I do remember correctly, that was the first time we met. And all of the jars and spices and everything on the walls at the refinery were iterations of vermouths and bitters and all kinds of stuff. And that is actually what Jonathan got to see when we first met, because he had learned about what I was doing at the refinery on Scout Magazine. Was it Scout back then?
Or was it something else? Facebook.
Was it Facebook?
Yeah, Andrew was still doing Waiter Blog back then.
Oh, Urban Diner.
Yeah,
whatever. Yeah. So I was making things already, but they were really designed just for fun. They were really great products, like first iteration products of things that we were using in a bar program, but it wasn't anything that we had thought about above and beyond that. And I think when Jonathan and I first started dating in 2010, we were so intrinsically connected on like a passion for flavor level and also a passion for how do you capture your life's work? How do you capture everything that he knows about food and everything that I know about beverage and put it together in a really beautiful product? And Bittered Sling was born in that moment. Do you have anything to add? I'm sure that you do.
Well, so I met Lauren. I read about, she was doing a handheld nitrous espresso siphon, and she was expelling spices and citrus peels through it, and was writing about, you know, different flavor combinations. And I was like, that's so cool. And this bartending thing looks like it's really interesting, because at the time I liked beer and I liked beer and I loved wine and I liked beer. And so I wasn't really into cocktails, except like late at night, you know, in a club, I'd have like, you know, gun vodka sodas. And so literally it was so eye-opening, because I went to the refinery and I took Peter Zambri, who was in town, and I said, listen, we're going to check out this bar. And I think that the bar manager is doing some really cool stuff. And at the time, this is 2010, and I was just so into modernist cooking. And I think, you know, at that point in my career, I was just as immersed in food as I could have possibly been. And what I mean by that, you know, I was in my early 30s, and, you know, so I had quite a bit of experience. I was working for a really great company. I'd cooked in Italy and China and Mexico and done all of this stuff. So when I met Lauren, she was talking about things that were brand new to me, but using a culinary vocabulary that was very avant-garde and very of the time. And so two chefs sitting there, both of us just like completely enthralled with not only, because the refinery was interesting. It was very, you know, sort of like rafters, lofty. It was cool. It was a cool place. But everywhere, every nook and cranny of this bar was stuffed with Grolsch bottles and the grainy mustard jars that had been refilled. And there were different colors and there was stuff floating in them. And
And we're like, well, stuff, no, good stuff, not like leftover mustard or anything.
What is that? You know, what's what is going on here? Again, in context, this is, you know, right when, you know, London is exploding. You know, Sean, I agree with you 100%. Australia was, you know, 5 to 10 years ahead of North America easily. When I first started cooking, the gateway to new knowledge was Australian cooking magazines. And there was nothing like it in Canada. So Australian Vogue, Australian Traveler, and, you know, all that kind of stuff. We were reading about what was happening in, you know, in Sydney and Melbourne, but we didn't have access to what was happening in London. And we didn't really have access to what was happening in New York, other than the New York Times Sunday paper with their big food and drink pullout. Because this is 2010, and the internet is, you know, like, it's there. You can go online, but it's not like it is now. Like, people were still pretty secretive about things, and we didn't have access. Mm. So, you know, she's pulling these house-made vermouths made with black walnuts from Vista Doro Farm. And, you know, we're smelling it and going, oh my God, because we know what these walnuts are. And we're like, how did you make this? And then here's a mango bitters, and here's a Shanghai rhubarb bitters. And we're like, whoa, what is this? And then here's how they taste in drinks, and here's what they do in the drinks. And so I think Peter might have even said, you know, what the fuck are bitters? You know, and so she pulled out, you know, a few things and showed us how they modify and create balance and can transform the direction of a cocktail bill. So we left that meeting, but like that, it was like pre-drinks. It was early, like 5 o'clock in the afternoon. We left and Peter's like, there's so much electricity going on with you guys. I think that you're going to do something in the future. I'm like, I know, I asked her out. I said, we're going to meet at Cafe Medina tomorrow and have brunch. And
that was 10 years ago.
That was 10 years ago. And so like, we just had this instant connection and we talked the same language about flavors. And for me, it was the exploration of something new that was so exciting. So then that's when I started to learn about spirits and cocktails and distillation. And, you know, I took my knowledge as a chef with how flavors work together and interact with the palate. And we started to take these recipes that Lauren had, because she had like dozens and dozens of bitters recipes. But we started to really work the recipes and evaluate them and doing, you know, different builds and, you know, seeing, well, what happens, you know, what happens when we change the bittering aspect in, you know, the ratio of the cocktail of the bitters build? What happens, you know, when I know this spectrum of spice flavors that really harmonize perfectly together? What happens when we apply a fruit to them? What happens, you know, we know that sugar can do something dynamically on the palate, but what happens when we eliminate sugar? How do we create a sense of sweetness? How can we really take something that is endless in terms of the ability to create? You can put any sort of spice combination with bitter roots, barks, leaves, and fruits together to an infinite level of creativity. But what actually works with a really good tequila a really good gin or a really good
vodka? I have something to add. And he's like, what?
How does it work? You know, and so that's how we started working together on Bitters Lane.
Listen, I heard many question marks in there, but I thought that they were rhetorical questions. Okay. And the other thing, Sean.
11.
The other things that were really important is that, you know, we talk about it a lot, like say, even in world class, just because you can doesn't mean you should. Mm-hmm. And you always ask the question, why? Why are you using a specific flavor? Why are you making bitters? Why are you deciding to pair these ingredients together? And I think for us, especially in the very beginning, the reason why I started making bitters in the first place is is because there were none available. And you know that wholeheartedly, that green and yellow chartreuse were not available forever.
Maraschino.
We never had Maraschino. Punta Mas was only available by the six pack, and it was crazy expensive. So we were in a weird position in Vancouver and also in Victoria, because you've got the fast ferry that goes to Seattle as well. To be that close, to be 2.5 hours away from Seattle, and to know that you could walk into, you know, at the time, you know, Zigzag was the place that we probably learned as much about cocktails and spirits as I think someone working hands-on in a bar in New York at that time. So bartenders that were, you know, living in Vancouver would end up traveling down there to learn about different vermouths available and Amaro and Fernet. Like when we started like getting more than one Fernet, when people realized in Vancouver that Fernet was a category, it wasn't a brand. Like that took so long, and we only made real headway in that in like probably 2012, 13. Like it was a really long time for bartenders to operate without the same ingredients to make the cocktails respectable and to make them to the point that honored the culture that came before, that created those recipes to begin with. And we just didn't have that. So Bittered Sling, you know, I guess the prototypes before that, the reason why we were making bitters was to show that the Canadian sensibility and our ability to create these global flavor palettes and to be a very inclusive flavor profile, to include flavors from all over the world, to create a catch-all aromatic bitters, to create something that is a New Orleans style bitters, to make something that could really amplify tropical drinks, whether tiki or from another part of the world. That the intention was always to show that Canadian products were just as superior as other products around the world. And I really felt that in the beginning that we were able to really showcase our talents as bartenders and chefs, even beyond Bittered Sling, to showcase that we had some of the best palates and some of the best understanding and education and ingredients in the world to play with. And the only thing that was limiting us was our imagination and our ability to get in front of people and tell the story of the product. And Bittered Sling always from the beginning was sugar-free, coloring-free, still is today, because it was meant to tell the story of the local product. It was meant to tell the story of the neutral fruit spirit that was made from ugly fruit. Well, at the time, it was just called fruit. It was just fruit, because I don't think that we were evil enough to call it ugly. All fruit is beautiful. But we had the spirit. We were working with Okanagan Spirits for years to bring that to life. And by adding sugar and by adding artificial coloring or sweeteners or anything to that, and it felt like the conversation was false. It felt like the ingredients were not true, and we wanted to showcase how amazing their spirit was and how incredible the blend of whole botanicals were that we were bringing together, and just how it could transform things in a classic cocktail. Like to make a Sazerac with, say, Suyu's cherry, with Suyu's cherry and Kensington together, you almost don't need both. I mean, you can just use Suyu's cherry on its own, and it tells the story of, you know, the beautiful products from the Okanagan. And Suyu's, for a lot of people, they can't pronounce the word and it autocorrects to something random, and that's fine. But Suyu's is the original South Okanagan dialect for Osoyu's, where our cherries come from. And we thought that was a really cool story to share, but then we built it in the way of a New Orleans style aromatic bitters that could be used in a Sazerac or could be used in, you know, in a Vieux Carré or something else. And so that was really the start of Bittered Sling. And it's pretty cool to see how it's built over the last decade.
What year did you actually launch Bittered Sling?
In 2012.
So yeah, 8 years now. You've had some, as a brand, you've had some huge success worldwide. And you're available in how many countries now?
Six.
Well, we've got online shipping to 55 countries. Yeah, but I think like for distribution, for someone that wants to bring us into the bar program, six countries.
Wow. And so how as a couple have you, obviously you have a very good rapport together, but working together as a couple is always a interesting. Some people either love it or hate it, And
you're really picking your words carefully, aren't you?
I'm really trying right now. Best podcast ever. But as a couple, like, do you work off each other's strengths? Because, like, Lauren, you're already ridiculously busy with World Class, and you have been since about 2016. So, like, you really start looking at timelines of when you launched Bitted Sling, the your old Bitted Sling bistros that you used to do, along with, like, everything that happened with World Class and moving to Amsterdam and everything. Like, 8 years is a lot of stuff that's jammed in there. And how as a couple have you worked together to build the company out the way it has been built out?
One of the things that is perception versus reality is you know, the perceived global success of a small bitters company.
A startup company, you know, let's be honest.
You know, when you look at, you know, a great bottle of gin and how you move cases of a spirit through a bar, through a program, you do it in ounces, you know, usually two at a time. Yep. Whereas bitters are sold or bitters are used literally 1 milliliter at a time. So
you're waiting a long time.
So, you know, like we've had great success with amazing bartenders in high volume drinks. You know, one of our, you know, most popular bitters is Plum and Root Beer. And that's probably in more actual programs than any of the other ones. But so this isn't about really making money. As a goal, this is about we started a company that we really believed in, and then we wanted to make the business work. And honestly, one or both of us have always had a full-time job throughout our entire time. We've never been in a position where we've both been working on Bitter Sling or a sustained period where Bitters has supported our household income. And that's a reality. You know, I've worked as a, you know, consultant, executive chef. You know, I was running three restaurants right in Vancouver before we moved here. And, you know, I would have loved to work on Bitter Sling full time, but the economics of it are, you know, we've created a business that makes sense. And, you know, is financially successful, but it's by no means making us rich, nor is it a business that where we're at the volume of, say, like a Scrappy's, you know, who's doing, you know, international sales, you know, cases and cases and cases. So, you know, we continue to work really hard in our professions. You know, Lauren has been the Diageo Reserve Global Cocktailian for 3 years, going on 4 years now. And that is a full-time plus job. And you know, at the same time she was doing that, I was running three restaurants. And so the way we set the business up was we've got amazing contract partners, and we have amazing Bitter Babe ambassadors who work with us to help generate
connections.
Love and advocacy.
Yeah.
In each market. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we just work really hard to make the business work because we love it. Like, we don't have kids, we have bitters, and we look at
plants. We have a lot of plants with human names.
And we often, you know, we often say to each other, this isn't a bitters company. This is a lifestyle brand about hospitality and about community. And so what we've seen, you know, in the last 2 months is that community really come together and really grow. And it's been amazing. And none of it is about sales. It's all about making sure everybody's okay. And how, you know, how can we support that? So it's really, really amazing to be in this position. But at the same time, you know, if anyone needs a chef in Amsterdam.
Yeah, I mean, ironically, to the tune that Jonathan's singing right now, you know, it's never been in a position to support one or both of us full time. And I'm like, well, it kind of is now, because I mean, we're in Amsterdam, and you know, I'm still working for Diageo, which is amazing, And because we've created this giant online program called World Class Community Week, I'm sure you've seen it. and Jonathan is, I mean, we feel really fortunate to be in the position where Jonathan can really just focus on Bittered Sling right now until we know what's next in terms of Amsterdam for him. Getting here in December, we moved 4 days before Christmas and arrived here, and it was the same, roughly the same weather as Vancouver and Victoria, except we're higher up in longitude. So it gets dark very quickly for a very long time, which is, you know, exactly the opposite now. It's light out until 10:30 at night, but it was raining and dark for 2 months when we got here. And then just as things started to open up again, and then this situation happened. So we're looking at everything as signs, as my mother would say, everything happens for a reason. And I think I guess that little anecdote, when you're younger, you don't really believe it. But I think as you get older, you start to really see the signs and embrace things for what they are. And had we come here and Jonathan jumped into something right away, I think it would have been really challenging because, Bittered Sling is one of many brands on the supply chain in all bars and restaurants that end up suffering. So, yeah.
So I've got a couple of questions to my left here. Sean did have some questions, but he hasn't asked them. He's like, just two quick things. I'm like, okay, hey, what's up, Sean? And then nothing.
He's having breakfast.
Yes. What is your favorite creation and what are you most proud of?
What, in terms of like bitters?
I think let's line that up with bitters, because like you have your core brand SKUs. You've just released a brand new pack.
Yeah. Did you get it in time?
Not yet. Mail to Vancouver Katie, Island has
Katie Ingram. Well, Katie's doing all the things right now, so I'm sure it's on its
way. Listen, we haven't even seen it.
mail to the island has not been great.
It's not existent. Yeah, you have like that pesky channel in the middle.
Yeah, we could be a different country and it still would not get, it still takes as long. How many SKUs have you, I suppose this might be a big number, how many different styles of bitters have you created in the time of Bittered Sling?
Oh, I can answer that. Okay, ready?
Please do.
12. I would say upwards of 25, probably.
Wow.
And that's because we've also done a lot of custom jobs, and we've done one-offs for programs that we built with other brands. Like, for example, we did Le Grand Sling bitters with the Marnier family back in 2016. We just launched the Tanqueray Tropical Citrus Heart bitters, which is inspired by flavors of the Amazon blended with Canadian and global ingredients.
Let's not forget the folklore bitters created for Jerry Jones.
Yes, and also the gunpowder for Justin Taylor.
Yeah.
We also did the proprietary bitters for Tales of the Cocktail back in 2015. We design bitters for Craft House, which is Charles Release company as well. So we've been fortunate to do a lot of really cool projects. So I think the SKUs that we work with now, we say 12, and of that we say 11 because Western Hascap is no longer available except in our Creative Flavors gift pack. So we say 11.
Hascaps become a pain in the ass to get, apparently.
You know what was funny? It was one of those. It was one of those products that was just like everywhere. Like I had suppliers, three or four different suppliers coming with, these Hascap supplies. It must have been, like a commodity product that was, just get rid of it because it was everywhere for the longest time, and then it just like it dried up. It's one of those really beautiful. So we had a Western Elderberry bitters.
Oh, this story is so fun.
That was one of my favorites. Yeah. And so we launched with it in 2013, I believe. And we bought the elderberries from
Glorious Organics.
Glorious Organics, which was...
Do you want me to tell the story?
No, I'm just not putting it together. I got to go back in time. Okay, I got it. So, Glorious Organics, they do salad greens and they do amazing organic vegetables. And I was talking to the farmer and Susan, and she's like, I've got, all these elderberry trees. And I'm like, oh, look, let's do elderberry bitters. And so we did some R&D on it using dried elderberries, and we were waiting for elderberry season to come along. And so the thing about elderberries is they're only actually on the tree for hours, because birds get to them, animals get to them.
And like, if you don't net the tree, you're ruined. Yeah.
So the first year that we got the elderberries, they arrived. We were working at our commercial kitchen was Campagnolo Restaurant, Campagnolo upstairs. And so we used to work first thing in the morning. We had a catering company as well. And they dropped off the elderberries. I think it was 10 kilos of elderberries, but they just took a saw and they cut all the branches off.
they brought us all like a tree.
All the branches with all the berries still on it.
And you can't use the stems because the stems are really bitter, and that's why you don't use the stems when you make elderflower liqueur either. Because
so we had Layla Francis and Sabrine.
Oh,
and
Sabrine. She was an elderberry picker from
We literally a long time picked ago. All of the elderberries off at the trees. And then do we make it one more time?
Yeah, we made it one more time. And then they forgot to net the tree, and they called and said, listen, we don't have elderberries this year. And we said, okay, so what next? And she's like, well, we didn't put the net on the tree, and the birds came much earlier than previous years. I'm like, you need a farmer's almanac, my friend. But
this leads to, you know, a really important. So kids who are starting businesses in your homes, it's great to have grand ideas of, you know, an elderberry bitters. If you're just going to sell 100 bottles, but if you want to sell a few thousand bottles or 10,000 or 20,000, or
you want Canada and the US to carry it, really,
you know, if you want this something to be scalable, you need to really evaluate the ingredients that you're using. And so what we
plums are scalable.
so we looked at our lineup and we really just started looking at it as a global business and how we could make the metrics work, you know, and this is something that we're all looking at now because everything's going to go up. Transport's going to go up. The price of, you know, just everything's going to go up. And so, you know, we have to look at that as well. We were in a, both a fortunate and an oh man, what are we going to do position when 2 months ago when everything shut down, because we had just invested in restocking our entire inventory
and the new gift packs were in the middle of production.
And you know, so we found ourselves, we had a warehouse, so we were a month into lockdown, and so, or maybe 2 weeks, 3 weeks, it wasn't very far in, but it was still in the nobody knows how long it's going to last or what's going to happen. And it was still kind of panic mode. And our bottler calls us up and says, you know, it's ready. You know, here's the bill.
Oh, hold on. I think the best part of that, we thought, okay, so this is very stressful. We've got all this inventory. They sent us the bill and we're like, oh my God. So we ended up figuring that out. And then 2 weeks later, they call us again and they say, oh, by the way, Plum and Root Beer is ready. We're like, what? And they said, well, remember, you did a late order for Plum and Root Beer. I'm like, oh, my God.
Anybody putting Bitter Sling on their list will have no gaps in SKUs.
Inventory is available.
But that was a challenge because, you know, we're a self-financed business. We're a small business. And, you know, the scalability of, you know, having SKUs, having people really fall in love with one of the flavors, like, you know, Plum and Root Beer or Clingstone Peach or Kensington. And then there'd be, you know, a gap. Oh, we ran out. Now we got to, like, you know, get some money together and then we make it. And, you know, the process is about 3 months. And so what we really, you know, put ourselves in a position of is no gaps, no interruptions of service. And that was this year was the very first time in 8 years that we were in that position. And then, you know, all this happens, but you know what, like, this is business. It's a roller coaster. When you're an entrepreneur, you're in a perpetual state of, going over the first hill on the roller coaster, just as you're cresting the top and you lose gravity. We're here, and we're here for until we're old and can't remember we have a bitters business anymore.
So you know what? It's funny.
Which maybe next week.
You don't have to be a dad to make dad jokes. Jonathan speaks like he's a dad. I think it's been really amazing to see how the industry has all come together, and definitely I get to see it firsthand with a lot of programs that we're running right now. And Bittersling, if Bittersling finds like a nice home in any of those moments, I mean, right now we're not doing anything really with engaging people, except we run a global happy hour. You know, that is it's the right thing for Bittersling to do, because we're not a big brand. We don't have the ability to just, you know, dump money into, you know, the benevolent fund or CPBA. And we would love to be able to do that, but it's not possible for us to do that. So we have to find other ways of supporting our industry and supporting the people that we love around the world. And so, you know, we've always been really, we've always been really proud. I think even you've seen over the years, Sean, like just even how the labels have changed. this couldn't be more of a startup if it had the word startup written on the top of the bottle, because like even when our bottles first came out, you know, our friend Carol Morton, who you know in Vancouver, Shmir to Mike Bernardo, who is the director of ops for Vidges, and she said, "Well, I'm studying graphic design." This is back in 2011, and we said, "Cool." And she's like, "I can do your labels." And I said, "But how much do you charge for that?" She's like, "I don't know, like $15 an hour." I'm like, "Great!" And so the first labels of Bittersling, and I know that we gave you a bottle of peach and pepper way back in the day, like 2011, 2010. And it literally had a damn label, a sticker that was printed at Business Depot. Okay. And then Carol found this little like labeling set where you could like pull letters off with tweezers and put new ones on. And it came with like an ink pad. And so we had to stamp, like change all the letters and then stamp it into the ink pad and then stamp it as hard as possible, like smashing it down to get it onto the label. And then we had to hold it out the window with shellac finishing spray like this, so we wouldn't choke to death. And then it was like, oh, those are ready. And then you put them on the bottle. Like that was like early days Bittersling before Tails called and they said, "Hey, we love your bitters, so we're going to launch them. Are you guys ready to go commercial with it?" We're like, "No." And they said, "Well, you've got 6 months." We're like, "Oh my God." So that, I mean, those are those moments where you, as a small business, you dream of those moments and you always envision what you would do if I guess the call came one day. Would you be able to do it? Would you rise to the occasion, or would you get, you know, super, super stressed out and just say, you know what, this isn't going to work for us, and then sort of blow your opportunity. So we thought we would try and take every opportunity as it came and just see what happened. And, you know, Tails was really like the big jumping off point for us in 2012 when they came to Vancouver. We did the first ever bitters market and we were there, and it was just our product and Agastura, which we thought was hilarious. And then Harold McGee comes walking by and he's like, "So Lauren, these are your bitters." I'm like, "Oh my God, who knows my name?" You know, like these are like worshiping moments for, you know, bartenders and chefs. And he was one of the guests that year. So, you know, he knew everybody that was involved quite intimately. And I guess that sort of led to us going to New Orleans that summer for the first international bitters market that they did. And we were among, you know, six or seven brands. And we felt really honored and thrilled and also terrified because it was taking our product into the US market. And, you know, that was 8 years ago.
And that was the interesting thing, because that first year there were six or seven other brands. And then the next year there was about 24 brands. Yeah. And then the next year there was 60.
And last year there were five.
Yeah. And then they reined it back. They reined it in. They said, "Listen, yeah, we just want to work with these few groups." And you know, to get back to the, you know, the sense of community, I think that's one of the most amazing things that's come out of this. The happy hours, when we first went into, when everything closed at first, we were hosting we didn't call it a happy hour. We had access to a Zoom platform. We could host, a lot of people, and we just created a WhatsApp group and we sent out an email to you were on that list, you know, 90 people. Just everybody, just to say, hey, hope you're okay. We're going to have a Zoom call every night at this time. It was actually, we started in the daytime here, so it could be nighttime there. And then we ended up finding the time that was right. And, you know, we started every day, and then that's segued into three times a week. And now we're going back to work. Things are starting to open in different communities. And there's just so much content and Zoom time now where we've paired it back to once a week. And we've just had the most incredible people. We've met strangers, you know, we've met them for the first time, and now they're some of our close friends, and they'll be friends for life in different cities around the world. And we all, you know, people come in from time to time, and it's just a safe place to be. And we don't really talk business. We don't really talk about, there's no topic. There's no making drinks. It's just, it's a hangout session. And for me personally, that's been the most incredible thing through this. You know, we're going into month three now, and it's been an incredible experience getting to know so many dynamic people from around the world.
And we needed it. Yeah. As much as everyone else did.
Yeah. Well, this goes back to the 24/7, you know, being together, working together.
Oh, is that what the question was?
It was a while ago.
An hour ago. But
this is actually the first time when we've both been doing the same thing at the same time.
In the last 3 years.
Yeah. So that's a long time. So I don't want to keep you guys any much longer, but I've got one question from Facebook saying, is there one location you wish your bidders were but haven't made the shelf yet? Or is it just everywhere? Well, 54 countries, that's a lot.
Brazil? Yeah.
I don't know. I think wish is a strong thing, because I think if we end up connecting with people and they hear the story about Bittered Slang, and of course, like, doing this session with you really helps get the word out, and, you know, all the work that we do around the world, like, we have no marketing budget, right? So everything is like guerrilla marketing. It's podcasts, it's Instagram, it's, you know, like, doing newsletters, it's whatever it is, getting in front of people and sharing our story. And then when you taste it, you know, it makes things taste different when you understand the story behind it and the people behind it. And our bidders are great. They stand out, you know, when they're on a shelf amongst other bidders. And I know you did a bidders podcast not long ago when you were tasting through, and they really do shine. Without Jonathan and I telling the story of Bittered Slang, we're so honored and proud that they do stand out on their own without any conversation. And I think anyone that's interested in working with Bittered Slang or hearing more about it or how they can get it, everyone needs to know that we wish to be everywhere, and we have the ability to be everywhere. And so we're just an email, an Instagram DM, a Facebook note, a text, a smoke signal, a pigeon carried message away. And we can get our product anywhere in the world, which is an amazing thing. And that's what we have invested in over the years, is the ability, like Jonathan said, using products that are actually scalable, creating a business that is scalable, so that when the time comes, we can rise to the occasion and be able to get the Bittered Slang love wherever we need to.
So this is my 160th episode. When this gets posted in a week and a bit, it's my 160th episode.
Oh my gosh.
Well, I've been doing an episode Monday to Friday during COVID. So I've done an extra 34 episodes.
Yes. Wow.
That happened that I would normally not have done. So this is my last week of everyday episodes. Next week we go back to regular schedule, because again, everybody's going back to work and all that sort of stuff. But I want to thank you two very, very much. I think we could probably talk for another hour and a half, but I'm not sure if anybody wants to watch that. Yeah, Sean's back. Jonathan started this interview without a gray hair. Now I'm pretty sure I can see a few.
Is that what he says? That was his question. He said two questions. I'll be right there. And then
that was
half. I know what he's doing. He's doing the 2 points thing. So in all of our tales, because we're both on committees for tales, and every time I had something to say, it was like 2 points. And I would say the first point is, the second point is. So he's taken
a. That's where it came from. You can't do in-house jokes on Facebook while I'm doing a Zoom. That's just
I know, right? Yeah.
Hey, Sean, thank you so much for having us on. And, you know, Lauren doesn't have as much free time as I do. I've been watching quite a few of your podcasts. And I just want to say that you've really done an amazing job of building global community and getting really important information out there. And thank you for that. And keep up the good work, man. It's been, I think, throughout these times, an amazing growth period for those who have been able to look for it and find that growth.
My life is a disruption, so I'm just used to it.
Awesome.
Yeah. To echo what Jonathan said, like really, really well done. And thanks for including us. We feel very honored and grateful to be part of your little family. So that's
perfect. Thank you very much, guys. Well, you have a good evening there and I'm going to have a good day. I think I've got an empty house now. I think my daughter just went out. So I've got work to do.
I have another Zoom call.
I was looking at the time going, I gotta wind this up. John, we gotta wind this up. Let's tie this up.
Okay. We'll see you soon, brother.
Thanks, John. Bye.